Proverbs 18:16. 18:16. Oh, this is one that I wish I could just sit every 15-year-old high school boy or junior high boy down and say, listen, you need to know this, okay? 18:16. Read that when you get there. It's right after Psalms, Proverbs. 1, 2, 3, goes to 18, and then, 16.
God opens the way to the giver and ushers him into the presence of the great.
All right. Read that one more time.
A gift opens the way for the giver.
A gift opens the way for the giver. Mine says a man's gift makes room for him. What are we talking about here? 18:16, this idea of a gift. What does that mean? When you think New Testament lenses, the word gift, what do you think about? Grace, okay. Maybe more specifically or more covered in the New Testament, when you hear the word gift, what does Paul talk about? Romans. How about spiritual gifts, right? So there's certainly a context scripturally for the idea of a gift being, you know, a spiritual gift. But that's kind of a New Testament concept. That's not Old Testament, okay? Other gifts are, you know, as we think through kind of a Western world, are your talents and your abilities, probably not what they're talking about here. So what is in context here, what is this talking about? A gift makes room, a man's gift makes room for him and brings him before great men. What is this gift? Any ideas? Let me ask you this. What does this gift do for the individual in part A to the individual that he's coming before in part B? Benefits them, right? So they're giving something that benefits them and opens doors, okay? What do we call that today? When you meet someone for the first time and you give them a gift and it opens doors for you because of the way that you handled yourself instead of in the presence of these great men, what do we call that? A blessing, for sure. The idea is this is a first impression. This person in part A, this man, is standing in front of great men, okay? Men that are more powerful, men of more renown, men that are older, men that are more important. This is a junior high kid standing in front of a dad. This is a potential employee standing in front of a boss, an employer, okay? And they're bringing their gift in front of them. They are making a proper and right first impression, okay? I can't tell you how many times that I just, in my generation, again, being from the South, I've got a bent in me that's probably stronger than maybe some of you, how poorly we do this as a society, right? We were selling a couch on Craigslist, okay, a couple years ago. It's always weird having Craigslist people come into your house, but, right, I couldn't bring the couch somewhere, so they came to our house. Mom walks in, Dad walks in, hey, nice to meet you, shook hands, super nice people. Here comes their 16, 17-year-old son, okay? He's got his head buried in his Nintendo DS or whatever he was playing. He walks in my home, doesn't look up. He's third in line. I go to shake his hand. He doesn't look up. He walks straight over to another couch in my house and sits down. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, you just came into my home and don't even say hello, much less look up and look in my eyes and say, good afternoon, and go sit down. I mean, nothing. He spent the entire time on the couch, like, I don't even know how he knew where the couch was, because he never got his hands off his eyes off his video game, sat down and played the whole time. Mom and Dad and I are negotiating, and hey, how much you want for that? Let's talk, whatever, let's carry it out. Mom's had to sit, you know, at the end of it all, hey, get up, help your dad carry this into the truck. I mean, it was unbelievable, right? One of the things that we are desperately trying to instill in our girls is that ability as young ladies to respectfully handle their elders, right? To look someone in the eye when they talk to you, right? We've made them do that. Say yes, ma'am. Say no, sir. To shake a hand, right? And especially as you're young, it's super uncomfortable. There's an intimidation presence in front of an adult. We're just trying to teach our kids there's nothing to be intimidated about. Look someone in the eye. Be respectful. Address them. Answer their question. And that's fine, right? You don't have to hang out with them or like them or whatever, but we're just trying to teach them common, like, normal interactive skills, right? As a guy that hires people to work for my organization, I looked at that kid and thought, I would never hire you. Not in a million years. I don't need a resume. I don't need to know what your talents are. Unless you're in a hole with a computer all day, you know, and you're completely useless to the world because you have zero interpersonal skills. Like, that's terrible. I am a relational idiot, and I realize that's not good, right? So make note of this. When you have these abilities to walk into a room, say, yes, ma'am, no, sir, shake a hand, nice to meet you, to ask questions of other people, that opens doors for you that you would be shocked that otherwise wouldn't open. And it's as simple as a first impression, right? It's not magical. You don't go learn it in grad school. It's just good human interaction and respect, right? I had a guy call me the other day who just got let go from a job. He's from Tennessee, relocated to Fresno, was at this job for a couple years, things went south, and they let him and another guy go, and it wasn't his fault. Great guy, right? He's the most respectful guy. He's like 2 years younger than me, and he calls me, yes, sir. And I'm like, okay, wait a second, no, it's Mike, but thank you, right? And he called me and says, hey, do you have any job possibilities at your organization or others? And I said, no. And then I ran into this guy the other day who was looking for people. And I said, you need to talk to this guy. I don't know his skill set. I don't know that it would even work. But I knew if I put this guy in front of said future employer, he will at least be impressed with this guy's character and who he is. Because he's going to dress him correctly. He's going to wear a tie to the interview. He's just going to present himself well. And whether or not he can sell insurance or not, they can figure that out. I don't know. But this guy's just a guy of character. And you learn that after spending about 15 seconds with him. You go, oh, wow, you were brought up a certain way, and that's very respectful. And when you're around other people, people enjoy being around you because you treat them with respect, okay? That is a very, very biblical quality, okay? By the way, Old Testament, there's a kid that lost his donkeys, and he's out looking for them, and the other guy that's with him says, hey, I know a guy that we could go talk to that will know where your donkeys are. And said kid says, no, we can't go see that guy. You guys know the story or know why that kid said, we can't go see this powerful prophet in the land? He said, I have no gift to bring to him. Saul said, I have no gift to bring to the great prophet Samuel. It would be embarrassing. It would be disrespectful of me to show up into the presence of a great man with nothing in my hand to offer. It would be disrespectful. And the guy that's with him says, hey, I've got some pocket change. We'll offer him this, that, and the other thing, and then we can go see him. And Saul says, okay, that's proper. That's correct. Okay? So, as you think about some of the greats in Scripture, okay, men and women alike, they will share this quality, right? Joseph, whose life we're about to get into, is magnanimous. His personality is amazing. And he no doubt had that ability just to win people over because of who he was, his character, and his interaction with other people, okay? So you'll be surprised at times how unspiritual things like that are. But just, man, open doors for you, okay? So make sure you have that quality about you, and make sure you communicate that to those that are around you and those whom you influence, especially those of you that influence the lives of the younger generation that's coming up. It's just so important, and it's unfortunate how poorly sometimes we do it, right? There's a time for fist bumps and a pat on the rear end with, you know, buddies, that's fine, okay? But there's a point where when you're in the presence of, in a different environment, we need to handle ourselves appropriately differently, okay? Thoughts on that? My rant is over.
Mm-hmm.
Man. We live in, and I think that's going to be, I think we're going to see, specifically with the cell phone generation, this get worse and worse and worse, like probably exponentially, because they're used to this. I was at dinner 2 nights ago with my girls. We were on a date night when my wife was leading Bible study. I take my girls out. And I watched a couple that was probably at least 15 years older than me sit at the table. Both had their iPads. And I watched them the whole time, literally the whole time. They did not look at each other one time. He's playing solitaire on his iPad. She's doing whatever. They never looked up. They never exchanged a word. We were there for easily 25, 30 minutes. Not one time. So I think there's literally a physical addiction, right, to our phones and whatever. It's hard in a 15, 20 minute, hour long tutoring session to say, hey, but I tell them, your phones go over there, when I'm here, you honor my time. If you don't want to do that, that's okay. But, you know, that's there's something that's changing. I think it's going to get worse and worse. So.
I think on that, like, if my junior hires from the very first day, I said, don't come to right here. And they smile about it because they will see their hearing life.
Absolutely. And here's my cell phone. I'm not going to text people. I'm not going to answer the phone either, right? And I'm guilty of it too, right? I like my phone as much as anyone else, and it gives me information. I mean, they're fine, but there's limits. So I've got a buddy that comes home at 5 o'clock on Friday, puts his cell phone in a drawer, and he doesn't get it until Monday. So very rarely will I receive a text back from him on the weekend. You know, sometimes he'll look at it, but he doesn't answer work calls. He just says, man, I need to shut off because I know my tendencies, and he's very disciplined with it. And I'm like, you know, it's a good reminder. So, okay, so there you go. All right, so Genesis, shall we? All right, so we had finished last Thursday. We were off on Friday. Story of Jacob and Esau. We watched these two finally reunite. We're seeing peace between these two brothers. To some degree, we're going to see some odd interactions here in chapter 33, in kind of the end of this and the rest of the story. But Jacob is now back from the promise, or back into the promised land. Has left Laban up north in Paddan Aram, is home or is coming home because of the call of God in his life. And now he's interacting with Esau. All is good, as best we can tell. They have had a good exchange, and they're at least cordial again, okay? So we'll pick up the rest of the story right now. Let me pray for us, and then we'll dive in and kind of get into it. Father, thanks for this morning. Thanks always for your book. I pray, God, as we continue to read just lots of text and as we roll through stories, that we would not get lost in the minutia of this, that our hearts and our minds would continue to be inclined to you, to learn, to study, and to just to fall more deeply in love with a God who loves us and created us and made us to worship him. So God, would you use this morning as always for your glory, and would you use it for our sanctification? In Christ's name, amen. All right, so let's pick up in chapter 33. Kind of, we got to the reuniting of these two. Esau is a totally different guy than we expected. It's been a 20-year gap, I guess, between the leaving and them now seeing each other again. He is incredibly gracious to Jacob. That anger and that animosity has now kind of calmed down. So remember, Jacob had sent all these droves of animals right in front of Esau to so they could see all that was these gifts that he had. And an idea, or his idea, Jacob's idea, was to hopefully appease the wrath of Esau that it turns out he didn't need to appease. Okay? So he asks, Esau asks in verse 8, what do you mean by all this company? And he said, to find favor in the sight of my Lord. Okay, so that was the purpose of these gifts. Esau says in verse 9, I've got plenty. I don't need anything. So thanks, but I don't want all your stuff, which is, you know, again, a great response. Okay, Jacob insists in verse 11 or 10 and says, no, I've got this stuff. God's blessed me. You take it. Verse 11, accept the gift which has been brought to you because God has dealt graciously with me and because I have plenty. Thus he urged him and he took it. Okay, so Jacob ends up giving this significant gift to his brother, and then they go on a walk. Okay, 13 and following, or 12 and following, this is Esau's suggestion. Watch what he says to Jacob in verse 12. Okay, so what's Esau saying? Let us be on our way. What does that mean? Let's go. And how are they going to go? Together. Okay, so let's leave town together. Okay, now let's do this real quick. Will someone kill? Oh, my cursor. Where did you go? There we go. Will someone kill one of these lights? Can you do it from? I think they're just over there. I'm sorry. Will someone kill? That's a bad way to finish a sentence. So let's do, sorry, I want to show you guys a map, or you can kill both of them, that's great. We may have to turn it back on in a second because I can't read in the dark because I'm too old.
I don't need glasses yet, but I may need more vitamin, whatever it is. What's the one that makes you see in the dark? Arrangement. No, the vitamins that help you see in the dark. You silly.
All right, we good? Okay, so again, here's the map, all right? So Paddan Aram is up north. This is up here, the Sea of Galilee, Dead Sea. You guys are very familiar with this. So Jacob has now rolled south, okay? He wrestled with the angel of the Lord right here in Penuel or Mahanaim, okay? So that is where they had that interaction. And now he's here with Esau. So he's met him at Penuel, and they're now going to have a conversation here, okay? So I just want you guys to kind of know geographically where they're at. Now, when God met with Laban, with Jacob, where did he tell Jacob to go? Remember, Jacob tells his wives, hey, God told me to go back to the land. Where was that? Do you recall? Did God give a specific location? Bethel, okay? He doesn't say Bethel, but he identifies himself, I am the God of Bethel. That's what he tells Jacob. Go back. It's time to leave Laban. Go back into the land, okay? Here is Bethel, okay? So again, Jerusalem is right here, okay? Bethel is up here. This is when Jacob, again, left home from the Negev, from Beersheba, sleeps with a rock underneath his head, has his dream that occurred in Bethel, okay? Jacob is going to take a slight delay before he goes to Bethel, and God's going to spank him and say, now, get up and go to Bethel. So he doesn't clearly state where he's supposed to go. He knows it's back in the promised land. If you were Jacob and you were going back in the promised land, where would your tendency be to go? Probably Bethel, right? Because you had your last interaction there with God. That was the most significant place. Okay, so that would be the idea. Okay, so with that in mind, yeah, I'm going to need, sorry. Give me one light. I can do one. Thank you, Melissa. Let's pick up in the rest of the story. Let's see what happens. So Esau says, let's roll together, okay? 13, look at Jacob's answer. Okay, keep rolling.
So let my Lord go on ahead of his servant while I move along slowly at the pace of the drove before me and that of the children, unless I come to my Lord.
Sair, okay. Now, where's Esau from? You guys remember? Up in here, or down in here. You guys see that way down south? Right where my head is. Down there, okay. That's Sair. So they're up here. Esau is going to take this journey down, okay. So he says, hey, let me go at my own pace, right? I got women and children. I need to treat them gently. We can't go like you go with 400 armed men. We can't travel like that. So go on ahead of us. And where does he say they're going to meet? Sair, we'll meet you down here. Is that the promised land? No, that's where Esau lives. But he tells Esau, I'll meet you down there. Let me go first, okay? Read into that to me. What's Jacob doing? What would you guess? Hey, let's travel together, right? Which would be wise, because Esau's got 400 fighting guys. Would you want that kind of protection? Yeah, probably not a bad idea, right? But he says, no, you go ahead. I'll take my wives and my kids and our cattle, and we'll go at our own pace. We'll see in a couple days. He's wanting some distance between the two of them. Why? He doesn't trust him yet, right? He's had an incredible interaction with Esau. He's been, you know, kind of amazed by the grace that was bestowed upon him, but he's still a little like, I don't know. And he's still got a little bit of Jacob in him. Do you guys see it? You see the deception? Okay. So he says, you go on ahead. Esau says, hey, 15, let me leave you some people who are with me. Okay. So great, I'll go ahead, but how about I leave you some protection? Great offer, right? Not so much. What need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. So Esau goes home, okay, and Jacob says, I'll catch up to you. Okay, now, whether or not he meant, I'm going to immediately turn to Seir, right? I'm headed that way, like the next stop on this journey is south, or hey, let me go home, let me set up shop, and then I'll come visit at Christmas. I don't know, okay, but you get the idea that he clearly told him, we'll meet up in Seir, all right? So Esau says, great, we'll roll home. 17, watch where Jacob goes. Sukkoth,
where he built a place for himself and made shelter for his God.
All right, so here is Sukkoth right here, okay? There is a holiday in Israel named after this town, Sukkot, okay? The Feast of Booths, where in Israel they set up all the tabernacles or tents in the wilderness to remind them of the Exodus journey and how the people lived for a season. We'll get into that in Exodus when we walk through kind of their holiday schedule. For lack of a better word, their seasons of worship and how God commands them to worship. That's where he goes, okay? And what does he do there? What do you notice? He pitches a tent. What else? Sets up his livestock. Does that sound like they stayed for like 3 days camping? That sounds a little permanent, doesn't it? Right? So he sets up shop. He builds for himself, mine says house, which it probably wasn't brick and mortar and, you know, with a concrete driveway or what have you. But he stays there for a bit. He makes arrangements for his livestock. This isn't temporary. He stays there for some duration of time, okay? Now, that sounds like I wasn't intending to go to Seir immediately. I'm setting up shop, okay? So he stays there for an undisclosed amount of time. And then at 18, where does he go then? Okay, so here is Shechem, okay, or Shechem, however you guys want to say it, it's up to you. Okay, so there's Shechem up here. Okay, now you guys remember Mount Gerizim, Mount Ebal. This is kind of in the valley between these two mountains. We've seen Shechem before. It's a part of Abraham's journeys. Now, these guys have lived down south in Beersheba and south in the Negev, but this is a city that they would have known. So kudos to Jacob. Where is he now? He's in the land, right? That's the promised land. So, okay, you're at least in the right geography. So he goes to Shechem, and he sets up shop there. Okay, so, well done.
So, do you have to Google ancestors
better? Mm-hmm. Some, not all. So, but yeah, Esau would have left with more than he came with, for sure. Okay? So that's the idea. What else does he do? 19. Lohi Israel. It sounds like Hawaiian, doesn't it? Like you should do a dance. We don't do that. So he buys a piece of land, and he's in Shechem. Who do you notice is living in Shechem? Who's the guy that he buys this land from? Hamor. Okay, so these guys are Canaanite people living in the land. Now, down south, had he went to Beersheba and went home, who would have been living there? Some portion of his family, or at least people that feared God, this guy doesn't. So he's living in a land where he's the minority in terms of believer, and he's living in a land full of unbelievers. So he stops in Shechem. Now, knowing Jacob, why would he do that? He's a pretty shrewd guy, right? Why would he stop there? Think, father. He's got stuff. There's non-Christians in the land. Is it selfish or unselfish? Probably selfish. Okay? Why? Think Lot. Why here? Why did Lot go to Sodom and Gomorrah? Okay? For the money. So there was an opportunity here for him to make money, and we're going to see that. He's going to interact with these people. He's going to have an opportunity to buy and sell goods. He's going to raise cattle. This is not a bad place to be. It's not necessarily sin for him to be here. However, God says, I'm the God of Bethel, go home. He's going to have a significant oops in chapter 34, and God's basically going to put his hands on the chalkboard and say, now, go to Bethel, okay? So this is not necessarily the best thing. Now, he could have been there. He probably could have made it. But he's going to get, 34 is going to be all about kind of Jacob's compromise and what happens in the midst of that. Yeah, Callie.
So, why did Esau leave? Because if Jacob left, wouldn't Esau have stayed with his parents?
Well, Esau's home is down south, so he's just going back to where he's from.
But, like, earlier, why did Esau go down there?
We'll see in the text that it says there's not enough room, and I think part of it was because his parents, there was that tension. He's a grown man. He's marrying daughters from Egypt, so he's like, he's 18, I'm getting out of the house, I'm moving, I'm leaving Fresno, so... No, Isaac's still alive. We're going to see him die in 35. Rebecca, we never see die, by the way. It never tells us when she dies. It just tells us she died. So, but we don't ever see an interaction with her and Jacob again. So he left town and never sees Mama ever again. Okay, as best we can tell, it's not mentioned in the text. We see that she's buried in chapter 49, but that's all we get. Okay, so... I don't know. That's what's weird to me. Why wouldn't you go home? Like, why wouldn't your tendency to be gone, to go see Mom, to go see Dad, to go... They don't do that. So it's just it's an odd deal. Okay, now they're Esau and Jacob are going to go bury Isaac, so they're going to have another reuniting, and it looks like everything's fine, but he doesn't go home. So whether this is a, man, I got too much stuff, and I need to set up my own place to live, and the land can't support us, that would certainly be potential, but... We just don't see that they reunite. You would think after 20 years that would be high up on his priority list to at least go stop by and say hello, right? But not so much, okay? So he buys land, sets up shop, starts doing business, and God's blessed him, so let's see how it goes, okay? 34:1, okay? This is going to be a rough chapter, so just to prepare you, and it starts rough. Okay, now, who would that be? Who are the women of the land?
Canaanites,
right? So they're hanging out with a bunch of non-Christians, okay? Which is fine, but brings consequences.
And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hittite, the prince of the land, saw her, he seized her and lay with her humiliated.
Okay, that we would use the word today, rape, okay? So this prince, this he's a very important figure in his society. His dad's a bigwig, right? He sees this daughter of Jacob and lays with her by force. So he rapes her in verse 2, okay? It's an atrocity. It's a horrible thing, and we're going to see kind of the aftermath of what happens as a result of that. Okay, that's Shechem. So remember that name, okay? So there's a city of Shechem. There's this dude named Shechem whose dad is Hamor the Hivite. Okay, now in verse 3, you get some more just oddities about this guy. Keep going.
And his soul was drawn to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob. He loved the young woman and spoke tenderly to her.
Like, really? You just raped her. You love her, and you're speaking tenderly to her? Like, you can see this is just an odd situation. Okay, so he rapes this girl, and now wants to spend more time with her, okay? Verse 4, Shechem says to Hamor, I want this girl for my wife, so go get her for me. That's what I want. Now we got a problem. Verse 5, Jacob heard that Shechem had defiled Dinah, his daughter, but his sons were with the livestock in the field, so Jacob kept silent until they came in. Okay, so Jacob gets word that his daughter was raped. So it's a very clear picture of what happened. Jacob's sons are out taking care of the flock and the sheep. They're away, and Jacob keeps silent. Now, remember, how many daughters does Jacob have? One from Leah. He's got 12 sons at this point. He's going to have, is that right? He's going to have Benjamin here in chapter 35. There's 13. Is it 11? I think he's going to have 13 kids. Is it? Yeah, because I'm sorry. Joseph gets divided into two tribes. There's actually 13 tribes, but yeah, he's got 11 sons at this point. Benjamin will be the last, okay? But one daughter, okay? So obviously, you can imagine how he felt about his one daughter, right? So so what do you notice about verse 5? Make some observations for me. What is Jacob's response? Nothing. Dads, paint that picture for me. Just talk about that. What would your response be in that situation? Yeah. right? It'd be, man, I hope I got some rich friends because someone's going to need to bail me out, right? Where's my shotgun? I mean, hopefully you would come to the defense of your daughter, okay? And not that, hopefully we wouldn't, well, I don't know what we would do, but hopefully it would be more than keeping silent, okay? So this is an unfortunate deal. So he keeps silent, okay? And this is going to create a problem. What do you call that in Jacob? What is he being right now? Passive, right? So he's not stepping up. He's not confronting the situation. He's not dealing with it, okay? Biblically speaking, what is the appropriate consequence to this action? Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 22 real quick. This is how God views this situation. Deuteronomy 22, verses 23 and following. 22, if a man is found lying with a married woman, then both of them shall die. Okay, so if they have, if there's an improper relationship in verse 22, a married man and a married woman that are not married, there is death on both their parts. Okay, 23, if a girl, a virgin, an unmarried woman, who is a virgin, engaged to a man, so she's betrothed but not married, and another man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the city gate and stone them to death. The idea is this is mutual consenting sex, okay? This woman is married. She sees another guy at a bar and says, hey, and it ends up that way. You take them both out into the city and you stone them, okay? They're both deserving of death according to Scripture, okay? End of verse 24, you shall purge the evil from among you. That's how God sees it, okay? So betrothed is as good as married in God's eyes, or at least it carries that weight. 25, different situation. But if in the field the man finds the girl who is engaged, and the man forces her and lies with her, what is that called? Rape. Only the man who lies with her shall die. The girl did nothing. It says there is no sin in the girl worthy of death. She is clean in this. She's not at fault. The man shall be brought out and stoned to death. So according to God's view of this, and again, we're fast-forwarding a lot into the Mosaic law, what would you assume Jacob would want or do at this point? So yeah, we need, Hamor, your son just raped my daughter. I am furious. We need to handle this appropriately, which means your son needs to die, okay? Verse 7, let's pick up there. Back to 34, Genesis 34, verse 7.
Just a quick question.
Mm-hmm.
That same passage we were just reading, Deuteronomy 22, 28, does that apply to the situation as well? Maybe it's only Israelites, but he's saying that if a woman is not engaged and she's raped, then she has to marry the guy if the guy can give money to her father.
How crazy is that? So your dad, daughter gets raped, she's not engaged. Now you tell the rapist, marry my daughter. Why would that be? It sounds horrible in our culture. Okay, you hear that and go, that's awful. Why would that be? Potentially pregnant, okay.
To make it right.
Potentially, and it's still not right, okay. Absolutely. This sounds harsh, but that girl is damaged goods, okay? She's not marryable anymore. No man will take her as a wife because she's been violated, okay? So this is a way of saying, no. Your actions have consequences, and you now need to own up to what you did. You had sex with her. You are now her husband. Like it or not, I'm the dad, I don't approve of it, but you are now betrothed because you had sex. How does God view sex in the Old Testament? Are you kidding me? Like, that's what it means, right? So you're now married. So you take care of her, you support her. You don't get to kick her to the curb. You don't get to send her a child support check and say, good luck. Mm-mm. You now take responsibility for your actions. I mean, that is a harsh reality of what God says, right? It'd be amazing if we did stuff like that today. You would see people's actions handled a lot differently if you had to live out and take responsibility for how you controlled or didn't control your body.
So it seems like there's two options outside of
Well, if she was already engaged to be married, that's what she said. No. You go with a husband that your father chose for you. That's appropriate. You're dead. Okay? Sorry, you're dead. Not sorry. You're dead. If not, then it is saying, this sounds terrible. This is in the best interest of the woman. We're going to provide headship for her. She's going to be cared for. She's not going to be looked upon as damaged goods for the rest of her life. You will care for her.
Was Dinah engaged to marry?
No.
Would that be disobedience then if Jacob didn't do that, even if the guy's a Gentile?
We're reading into it a little bit, so I don't know. Either way, Jacob's response bugs me. Now, should they marry non-Christians? No, she's not betrothed, so probably this guy should just die. Yeah, Callie.
What about, like, so they're betrothed? Would the guy be able to, like, break up with the girl if that happened to her?
He can, which is, that's the story of Joseph and Mary. Wait a second, we're betrothed. And now you're with child. So Jacob says, or Joseph had the opportunity to cast her away. And if she had, the assumption is, if she had willing sex with another man, what did Joseph have the right to do? Have her killed. I mean, as you think about the scandalousness of the gospel and like how Jesus came into this world, like that's insane. And that's how she was viewed. You're a harlot. Her whole town would have said, I mean, you just don't show up a child. Like, listen, 1 + 1 = 2. This is how it happened. Like, you slept with another man who was not your husband, and you should die. So he had every right to have her stoned. Yes?
Not giving Jacob an excuse, because I realize the honor would be pissed. But do you think he's waiting for his son to come? Like, is there any point that he could be waiting for his son to come? Because obviously,
yeah. Maybe. Let's see. Because I think that's fair. So maybe he's like Huck Finn counting 10, right? And I'm not going to blow up. I'm going to wait till sons are present. Let's see. Okay? All right. Sons of Jacob, verse 7, come in from the field. They heard it, and the men were grieved, and they were very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not be done. Okay, so we're very clear in the text what this is, how they're supposed to react. What do you notice is different about the son's reaction? They're angry, and what else? They're grieved. They're destroyed. They're wrecked over what happened. Do you see any of that with Jacob? No. Now, he very well may have been, but the text doesn't say it. The text says the sons are wrecked because of this. Okay? Now, let's keep going. Verse 8. Hamor spoke with them, saying, the soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage. So, now, with Shechem's options, what does he know is coming? What would he assume is going to happen? Marriage is the high road. Death. So what does he offer? My son's going to take care of your daughter. Okay, so let's make this right so you can see what he's doing. Don't kill him. He's gonna take care of her. Okay? Intermarry with us. Verse 9, give us your daughters, and we will take your daughters for ourselves. So let's intermarry. Now, we know enough about intermarriage and Canaanite culture to know that God's like, no, that's not how we want to do this. So that's not, again, Mark, you asked it. Someone asked it. Jason, you asked it. That wouldn't have been God's heart in this. Okay? So God's heart would have been, no, you kill the guy. Okay? And we grieve and move on. Okay? Thus you shall live with us in the land, and it'll be open before you. Live and trade and acquire property in it. What is Shechem saying to Jacob and his sons? Huh? Keep coming. We're not going to kill your son. Here's what we're going to do, Jacob. We're going to trade wives. We're going to intermarry your daughters, my daughter. All right, we're going to be a big happy family. And what else? What's the text say? Yeah, and what else? You're going to get land, you're going to get property, you're going to have opportunities to trade, you're going to make money. Who lives there? Who owns this place? Shechem, Hamor, right? He's the guy. Jacob's come in, set up shop, he owns a little parcel, and he says, hey, come into our family. This is going to be very advantageous for you. This situation is going to turn out for the good, okay? So he has an opportunity to make some money, okay? Shechem also said in verse 11, if I find favor in your sight, then I will give you whatever you say to me. What does that mean? Jacob, if you agree to this, what else do you get? I will sign a check and hand it to you. You just fill in the amount. Whatever you want, I will give it to you. Well, okay, hold on. That's a different deal. I get cattle. I get a blank check. How was Shechem described at the very beginning? Who was he? A prince. So his dad is loaded. So, you know, the king of Saudi Arabia who owns all the oil in the world says, yeah, well, let's make this right. Here's a check. Put as many zeros as you need. I got it in my bank account. Not a problem. You see where this is going with Jacob? Knowing why he probably moved into the land, do you think this is scratching an itch that he has? A little bit, okay?
Do you think Jacob had an idea that something might happen, and that's why he was silent?
Potentially. Yeah, I don't know. I think he certainly has leanings in that area. I think he knew. He's shrewd. He knows he has the upper hand. Like, he knows he's in a position to make the call, for sure. We don't find out. We just find out that he found out. So, I don't know. So, somehow we got the news. So, and obviously it's correct and right. So, okay. Verse 12 is ever so much bridal payment as a gift I will give according to as you say to me, but give me the girl in marriage. Okay. So that's the interaction. This is Hamor and Jacob speaking. Notice verse 13. Who speaks next? Jacob's sons. Jacob's sons answered Shechem and his father with deceit because they had defiled Dinah, their sister. So who has to speak up? His sons. Why is that interesting? What's Jacob continuing to do? Be passive. Is he being silent and waiting for sons to come home so they can talk and then he can lead the family? Doesn't appear that way. He is being a coward. And he is thinking about, wait a second, that's a lot of zeros on a check. So his sons have to speak. And now, because of their father's unwillingness to create proper boundaries, these guys are going to go off the handle. They are going to go nuts, okay? You talk about bloodlust and vengeance and vendettas. These guys are hot angry, which they should be, but they do not handle the situation properly. They go and take it too far and dishonor God in the way that they handle it because dad is passive right now, okay? So they answer. In 14, this is a brilliant response. Wonder where they learned how to conceive and conspire like this.
They said to them, "We can't do such a thing. We can't give our sister to a man who's not circumcised. That would be a disgrace to us."
Is that true? Absolutely. You're not circumcised. You're not in our family. This is God's sign of the covenant with us. We can't marry you because you're uncircumcised. So, keep going. Okay, so whole town gets circumcised, then we can talk, okay? That's a pretty, not just you, not just your son, everybody, okay? Then we will give your daughter to you, we will take daughters for ourselves, and we will live with you and become one people. Great, we'll live in peace, it'll be happily ever after, it'll be sweet, we'll walk off into the sunset, it'll be great. But if you do not listen to us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and go. How do they speak of, by the way, their sister? Our daughter. Why? Because dad's sitting on the bench right now with his mouth closed. That's our daughter. So they're having to step up and fulfill the role of father because father's not getting done right now. Okay? It's a sad story. Okay? Now, the plan is brilliant. Okay? Dinah was 7 when they left Padanaram. Okay? So just to put some context to this. So they've stayed in Sukkoth for some amount of time and there for some amount of time. So this is like a teenage girl. So potentially, the older sons can have kids. I don't know that it influences the story other than they're having to treat her like a daughter. And that's not necessarily odd language to use. Daughter, sister, this is not, you know, we see Solomon call his bride as much, my sister, my daughter. My sister, my bride. You just see the paradox here that shouldn't be. Jacob should be leading this, not the sons, okay? So Now, if you're Shechem and Hamor, you've got an odd request to go back home with, right? Hey, guys, here's the deal. My son Shechem is getting married here in a couple weeks. Here's what we all need to do. I mean, how powerful are you in the town when you say, all of you guys are going to get circumcised? Yeah, all of you, right? So that's what he does, okay? Now, this guy is just as shrewd as well. I want you to notice how he paints this picture, because if you're going to get circumcised, there better be an upside, right? So the young man did not delay to do this thing. Verse 19, he was respected more than all the other household of his father. So this guy is, they're both prominent men in the city. Verse 20, Hamor and his son go to the men in the gate of the city, okay, the official place of business, and said, these men are friendly with us, therefore let them live in the land and trade in it, for behold, their land is large enough, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters in marriage and give our daughters to them, okay? Only this condition, 22, by the way, we all got to get circumcised. 23, will not their livestock and their property and their animals be ours? So what's the offer to these guys? They're all going to have to get circumcised. Jacob and his sons are bringing what? They got livestock, they got stuff, they're loaded, right? So, man, you're going to get all that. So that's the upside that they paint to these men who've all got to get circumcised, okay? So all who went in and out of the city gate, verse 24, listen to Hamor, every male was circumcised, everyone out of the city gate, okay? Now it's one thing when you're an 8-day-old baby and you get circumcised according to Jewish tradition. It's another thing when you're a grown man and you get circumcised, right? It's a whole different ballgame, right? You are incapacitated. So I've got, it's a funny story. I got a cousin, and he had a best friend, and they had both, this is a little different but similar, right? They had all had families and kids and the whole deal, and they decided, okay, we're going to go get circumcised. And it was during March, so they're like, you know what we're going to do? We're going to have a party. We're going to go get a hotel. And we're going to watch March Madness, right? And the two of us will go get circumcised or get a vasectomy. And then, because we're not having kids, right? And then we'll get a hotel together, right? And we're going to lay up in bed, right? And we'll just watch, right? So he said, they're laying up in bed, right? They both got their bathrobes on and ice packs. And you can imagine the situation, right? And it's these two guys in a hotel room together, both married, both with kids, right? So they call and order room service. And here comes this guy, and, you know, it's a, come in, you know, and here comes the guy who walks in, and he's setting up all their food, and they realize in that moment, like, oh gosh, this must look really, really odd. But point of the story is, you're done. You're on your backside. You're not answering the door, you're not making dinner, and you're sure not fighting, right? So you've got every man in the city right now doing what? They're laying down, they're incapacitated, and it's not just like, hey, 20 minutes on, 20 minutes off of ice. I mean, we're going to find out that Jacob and his boys show up on the third day, right? So they pick like the peak of the pain when these guys are the most incapacitated. So they're down, okay? I shouldn't say Jacob. Jacob's sons show up 3 days later, okay? Verse 24, all who went in and out of the city all got circumcised. 25, now it came about on the third day, when they were in pain, that two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers. Now, why is that important? Who were Simeon and Levi, according to this text? Yeah, more so than the other brothers, right? They're blood brothers. From Leah, okay? So her full blood brothers, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, are all, and Judah were the first four sons born to Leah, okay? And then you get Dinah that's born later to Leah. So these are full-blood brothers, two of them, Simeon and Levi. Okay, so second and third-born sons of Jacob. Okay, you with me? So just keep that in mind. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, those are the first four in order. So the second and third come into the city. Dinah's brother each took, in verse 25, a sword and came upon the city unawares and killed every male. I mean, that's significant. Do you see the, what did you say? Yeah. I have a hard time disagreeing in the sense that you're seeing that, here's the problem. Their anger is a righteous anger, right? Their desire to make what is wrong right is appropriate. What's the problem? They need boundaries, right? They have bloodlust. They have, what did all these other men in the city do? Nothing. Shechem should die, right? Hamor should probably get his hands put on the chalkboard and say, you idiot father, you know, control your son. I don't know. But this is wrong. That's not appropriate. That does not honor God. Now, killing him, okay, I can't argue with that. I think God would have said, great, that's an eye for an eye. That's appropriate, okay? But this is not, okay? So they kill every male in the city, okay? And again, you talk about taking candy from a baby. That's it, right? Like, what are you going to do? Nothing? Okay, you want to get up? Nope, you're dead. It was literally, it was easy. So I don't know how many men that would have been. But I'm guessing it's probably in hundreds, right? In a city, families live together. I mean, it's a lot of men, okay? Apparently not. So you don't see anything from them, okay? They killed Hamor, verse 26, with the edge of the sword. They took Dinah from Shechem's house and went forth. So where's Dinah this whole time? Living with Shechem. Good job, Jacob. You don't even bring her home? Like, man. They took their flocks and their herds and their donkeys, which was in the city and which was in the field. They captured and looted all their wealth, their little ones and their wives and even all that was in their houses. So they loot the city like they had won a battle, right? They take everything, the wives and the kids. 30, Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, this is an amazing response. You have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the men who are few in number. They will gather together against me and attack me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my household. You're like, pardon me? What is Jacob's response in a nutshell? You got me in trouble, which means what? You made me odious in their sight. My business relationships just got cut off. Thanks a lot, sons. Like, are you serious, Jacob? And this is, it's haunting the way this chapter ends. Read 31. This is the response of the brothers.
But they replied, should he have treated our sister like a prostitute?
End of the story. What's Jacob's response? Nothing. He's silent because he has nothing to say. He knows they're right. Something should have been done. He did not have the courage to do it. So the sons had to step in and they went overboard. So again, it's an unfortunate situation. This isn't Jacob's fault that he was living in the wrong place, but you see the compromise from him being in the wrong place at the wrong time and how that's affected his family. He didn't protect them in a way that a father should, and as a result, there are consequences, right? Jacob didn't hope for that. He didn't wish that that would happen, but then it just piles on, right? And here they are, and sons have to step up, okay? So Simeon and Levi, right, are the two brothers that have, for lack of a better word, blood on their hands, right? They're the ones who are guilty of this. Turn real quick to Genesis 49. You guys remember kind of like each patriarch, when they die, they give their final hurrah speech. Jacob's is the most impressive of everybody, okay? So when he lies on his deathbed, he's going to give an incredible, like, long Old Testament history, and he's going to bless and curse his sons, okay? Verse 5, here's what he says of Simeon and Levi. I want you to notice how significant this life event is for these two sons. Read that. These guys are marked for the rest of their life with this moment. This was a fork in the road for these two sons. Because they have to take responsibility for this, right? So God holds them responsible for their actions. He doesn't just blame Jacob. He blames them for going too far. And because you slew men in your anger, because of the way you handled yourself, you're cursed, okay? Now here's something that's fascinating. What does it say happens to them? They're scattered, okay? Simeon, where does he end up? You guys remember? This is interesting. Let me. Where is my? Is that what I want? No. This is what I want. Oh, bugger, that's terrible. Okay. Here's Judah, okay, that's their land. Here's Simeon. Okay. Where does, and this map's just not real good in terms of colors, where is Simeon's land once it all gets divided? Can you guys see that? It doesn't go south far enough. Sorry, it's just tough to read. Judah gets this whole grip of land. Younger brother Judah gets this whole grip of land, and Simeon gets stuck inside of Judah. They have this little bubble of land, right? In Beersheba, in Hormah down here. Okay, they had the land of Beersheba, which is where we'll go visit. But he is stuck inside of big brother Judah. So that's part of his curse, okay? Now, who's the other brother?
Levi.
Okay, where's his land? He doesn't have land. Odd. So what does he say? What does Jacob say is going to happen with him? He gets scattered, okay? Now, we read that, and it's a curse here, but what's the blessing in that? Who's Levi? The priests. So what is God doing with this curse? He's making it a blessing, right? He's scattering that tribe throughout the nation. So, priesthood, you don't get to live in a bubble by yourself. You're going to be amongst the people. Your job is to connect people and God together. I'm going to disperse you. I'm going to take this action, which is bad, and I'm going to hit a straight lick with a crooked stick, okay? I'm going to use this to bring about my good, even though I'm clearly not pleased with the actions that were done by these two boys. Make sense? So one gets spanked and gets a little bit of land, and little brother surrounds him, okay? The other gets scattered all throughout Israel, okay? Now, if you look at it and say, okay, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, it looks like these two guys have just kind of blown it, right? They didn't end up on Dad's favorite list, right? So Reuben, the firstborn, should be the guy that's going to get the lion's share of the blessing, right? Okay, let's watch what happens to him. Okay, so back to Genesis 35, 5, okay? All right, so now watch what God says. This is kind of what you would have implied that God said from the beginning, 35:1.
Then God said to Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel and live there.
Go where?
Bethel.
And do what?
Make an altar.
Make an altar, build a house, right? That's where I wanted you to go in the first place. Go live there. So that's kind of the idea that God reminds him again, go there. So I look at that and say, I think Jacob knew when he was coming to the land, he was supposed to go to Bethel. On his way south to Bethel, he stopped in Shechem and went, whoa, there's some money to be made here. Let's just hang out. Let's rent a place, right? Well, let's buy some land. And we see what happens, okay? So Jacob goes. And he's going to lead now. So, Jacob, good for you, okay? He comes to his wives and says, put away the foreign gods of verse 2, which are among you, and purify yourselves and change your garments. What do you not like about verse 2? What do they have with them, his wives? Their idols, right? They got their G.I. Joe action figures. Now, that happened with Laban, so Jacob found out that, well, or maybe didn't, that at least Rachel had her household idols that she had taken with her when she fled Dad's house. They still have them. Jacob now steps up and says, get rid of them, okay? So do you guys see how, even how early on, this tie to Israel and idols and this oh, I like God, but I kind of want my good luck rabbit's foot as well, and I need my genie in a bottle. I like God. I don't not like God, but I want both, okay? And that is the story of Israel. Yeah, Layla. Yeah, watch what he does in verse 4 with them. It says he buries them underneath the oak that was in Shechem. So they're leaving town, and he buries them underneath the oak tree. So they're probably carved out of wood or made out of some metal. It's like, well, I guess you could have burned them. You know, you made a nice bonfire. That good, better, best, that may have been best. But at the very least, he's saying leave them behind. So I'm like, okay, I'll give you credit. You passed that one. That may not have been an A+. You didn't set them on fire and make a big, you know, bonfire out of it, but okay. So, okay. So he's at least trying to lead at this point, which chapter 34, he was the opposite. So I'm going to give him some credit, okay? They gave him to Jacob. He buries them underneath the tree in verse 4. They journeyed. Watch how God treats them. This is phenomenal. A terror was upon the cities which were around them, and they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. What does Jacob not have with him? He has no protection. He doesn't have Esau. And he told his fighting men to go with Esau, right? So how do the people around them treat him? Like, God is like, said, don't touch them, all right? And these people freak out with a bunch of women and children in Jacob, right? So God protects them and takes care of them, okay? Watch where Jacob shows up, verse 6. Yay! So he goes back to Bethel. He builds an altar, goes where God told him, builds now his second altar there and calls it El Bethel, again, the house of God. And he remembers that, okay? Oh, it's right there. Are you kidding me? No, it's Deborah. Sorry. I just about freaked out. I'm like, I looked for that this morning. Verse 8, Deborah, Rebecca's nurse, dies, not Rebecca, Deborah. She was buried below the tree, the oak in Bethel. So she dies there on this journey. God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Padan Aram and blessed him. In verse 10 and following now, we're going to see a repeating of the Abrahamic covenant. Okay, so he's going to remind Jacob, I'm with you. I haven't left you. And you'll see it. Verse 11, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company shall come from you. Kings shall come from you. Verse 12, the land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac, I will give to you and to your descendants. So you see God's promises. Though they are not completely fulfilled in Abraham or Isaac, they do not die with these men. He says, Jacob, you're a bonehead. You just came off maybe one of the dumbest decisions of your entire life where you failed to lead. I'm not done with you. Okay, so it's a great story of, again, God's redemption, even in the midst of him being a ding-dong, God is still gracious to him. Okay, so God went up from him to the place where he had spoken to him. Jacob set up a pillar of stone. Poured out a drink offering on it, and he also poured oil on it. So you're seeing even some of the Old Testament offerings and sacrifices that are going to get mentioned in Leviticus already done here, okay? So that's the idea. There you go, okay? 16, we're going to get baby Benjamin, okay? They journey in verse 16, go to Ephrath, which is they're on their way to, it looks like Jerusalem, okay? So on the map, they're in Bethel, which is up here, they are journeying to Bethlehem, okay, on their way probably to Jerusalem and then further down south. They get out of Jerusalem into Bethlehem. The town is called Ephrath in the text, and Rachel dies, okay? So this is Jacob's favorite wife now dies, and they bury her in verse 19 along the way. They set up a pillar over her grave, Rachel's grave to this day, okay? Israel journeyed, verse 21, and pitched their tent as far as Eder. Came about when Israel was dwelling in the land that Reuben, this is an odd little text, okay? They're living in the land. Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard of it. So we get one little verse on this. Reuben, who's who? Firstborn son. What does he do? Lays with his father's concubine. Okay, so this was, again, the handmaid of Leah, right? So he sleeps with his dad's concubine, okay? That means something in this culture. What does that mean? Reuben is making a statement. This isn't just I had the hots for and I slept with her, which is kind of weird anyway because she's much older. What is he saying?
Didn't you assume that he's in charge
now? Absolutely. This is the prodigal son saying, I wish you were dead. Give me my inheritance now. I am the man. So he's sleeping with his father's concubine. The idea is Israel heard of it, and everyone else would have too. This is a power play. Okay, we're going to see this again. One of David's sons is going to do this, and he's going to sleep with one of David's concubines on the palace rooftop for everyone to see. This isn't a private thing. This is like, I'm the man. That's how you did it. Okay, so this was an unfavorable deal. Okay, so of the first four sons, what have we seen in the first three? They've kind of disqualified themselves, right? Reuben, Simeon, Levi, they've all kind of done really stupid, okay? Reuben is going to get punked in Genesis 49, just like his brothers did, because of this action. And we get one little verse on it, okay? Now, who's the guy that ultimately gets the lion's share of the blessing? Judah, okay? Judah has a whole chapter of stupid, okay? So it's not like he's done a great job and God went, moral meltdown, moral meltdown, moral meltdown. Oh, you're fantastic, Judah. Judah's an idiot, okay? And for whatever reason, God likes to use idiots, so be encouraged, okay? So he's going to give him the blessing, even though he wasn't like an exemplary son in the process, okay? So Reuben does this. We get the 12 sons of Jacob listed here in chapter, or in verse 18. Just go back there for a second. Before Rachel dies, she has last son, Benjamin. Okay, Ben-Oni. Okay, it means son of honor or good fortune, or son of sorrow or misfortune. Okay, so just like Joseph, it either means to add or to take away. Joseph's name can mean either. Benjamin either means like son of good or son of bad. Okay, so it's kind of have these double meanings. Okay, so he's a blessing in that I had my son and then I died, but the problem is he's going to be sorrow and misfortune because mom had to die in the process of giving birth to him. Okay, so that's the idea. All right, so we get a rollout in verse 35 or rest of 35 of Jacob's sons. Look at verse 28. Pick up there, 28 and 29. All right, so he lives his last 180 years. Okay, Esau and Jacob come back and bury him. Okay, and they're going to put him again in the cave in Hebron in Machpelah. Okay, so with Mama and Dad. So Abraham and Sarah are in there, and now he's going to get buried in there as well. Okay, so, yeah. Yeah, he's going to rename him again. We're going to see. He does it right here, right? Is it? 35:10. Your name is no longer Jacob, but Israel. It's like, well, didn't you already do that? It is, and it's funny that today, what do we call Jacob? Jacob. We don't call him Israel, but we should, but we don't. So I don't know. It's like just one of those things, I guess, that's stuck in the text that he's still, for whatever reason, called Jacob. We don't call Abraham Abram. We call him by his new God-given name, Abraham. Right? I don't know. But yeah, I think he reminds him of that I've changed your name and it happens again. Why it's in there twice, I don't know. But
I have another question. In 35, where he's in Bethel, verse 15, so Jacob called the name of the place where God has spoken with him Bethel. So he's like naming it, but then God told him to go to Bethel.
Right. And he already named it Bethel, right, when he left 20 plus years ago. I think so. He's reminding himself, this is the house of God. This is where I met God, right? So he's bookends, if you will. So, yeah, that's kind of how I understand the text. Yep. Okay. Chapter 36, this is Esau's descendants, okay? So as you talk about a guy that God said, hey, listen, Isaac and Ishmael, I'm blessed in Ishmael, okay? He gets blessed. Jacob and Esau, Jacob, you're my chosen, but Esau, I'm going to bless, okay? 36. He gets blessed, okay? And you just get a bunch of names in here. Verse 2 and 3, Esau takes a lot more wives, okay? We remember Ornament and Tinkling, I think, were his first two, or were those Ishmael's? No, those are Ishmael's. He marries Basemath in verse 3. There's some other ones in there. Adah in verse 2. Whatever, you know, I don't know. I can't say any of these. But he marries a bunch of women, okay, and they're not godly. So that's Esau, right? Verse 6, Esau took wives and his sons, four sons and his daughters, his livestock and his cattle and all his goods which he'd acquired in the land of Canaan, and he went to another land away from his brother Jacob, okay? We know that down south, Mount Seir, Esau, who's going to be the father of the Edomites, okay? In verse 7, we see the reason, okay? Their property had become too great for them to live together. The land where they sojourned could not sustain them because of their livestock. So is Esau blessed? Yeah, just like God said, okay? So if you want to read about all these names, they're all going to be on the final. You need to know every one of them, okay? The relationship and draw the family tree, okay? That's actually the whole residency final is chapter 36 of Genesis. So make sure you know it. All right, now, 37, we're on to the last guy. Okay, so we've seen Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Now we're going to get little boy Joe.
When did multiple wives stop?
God, that's a great question. They don't.
So God never said, like, no more?
No. He, we're going to see it all the way up into Nehemiah's day, 400 BC. We're going to see issues with multiple wives. We're going to see it with David. We're going to see it with all the greats. Now, let me maybe speak to that a little bit. Similar to kind of the situation with the rape story that we read earlier, there was a way to take another wife that was honorable. In fact, in Deuteronomy, okay, use this example. So, Tony and Dave, okay? Yes. Your brothers, okay? Sorry, just making sure we're good here. Just make sure we separate the lines correctly. Your brothers, okay? Biblically speaking, okay? Tony, you've got a wife. Dave, you've got a wife. Dave, you die in battle, okay? So, you're very courageous, but you're dead. So, sorry, Melanie. Cry a little, okay? It's going to be okay. Your job as his brother is to marry his wife. Okay? Reason being, she's now a widow. Who's going to marry Melanie? Nobody. Where does her land go? Uh-oh. She doesn't have land. Who's going to raise for her male offspring? Well, she doesn't have sons. Your job as an honorable man is to marry her, ensure that she has a lineage of male children to make sure that she's properly taken care of. Okay? This isn't a harem. This isn't right? It's a way to say, listen, I'm going to honor my brother. I'm going to take his wife under my roof. I'm going to care for her. I'm going to raise her in a way that would have been honorable and proper. Okay, that's the welfare system in Israel. Okay, so it's not always jacked and like, guys are just pigs. You know, that's not, so it's kind of a weird deal. So God will allow it to happen. His heart is always one man, one woman. And then guys like Solomon will go, man, well, one's good, like 900's better, right? And that's what Solomon does.
So would you say that was a cultural thing? Because Israel put cultural limits on the married widow?
Yeah, I think in the New Testament, we clearly see the idea of one man, one woman for life. Now, here's a kicker, okay? So you guys familiar with Wycliffe Bible translators? Okay, so Wycliffe takes the Bible, translates it into the native tongue of different people all throughout the world, okay? One of the biggest issues they had was a culture similar to this, okay? So they translate the Bible, they read the Bible, they take Americans over to this culture, and they realize this guy has 9 wives, okay? And they go, okay, Bible says one man, woman for life. Who's your first wife? Okay, that one. Get rid of all these other 8. And they went, no. We do not like your God. Well, what was the assumption? The assumption through our American eyes was, you're a dirty perv and you have 9 wives. So you need to get back to a biblical standard and take one and get rid of the rest. And they said, we're rejecting your God and we're rejecting your Bible. And they said, oh, crud. And they realized they had their context all wrong. So this, can you imagine the theological debate that happened in a room where someone said, you know what? Maybe the right thing to do is for them to allow them to have multiple wives. And maybe their motivation is different than ours, and maybe it's a right biblical motivation, and these other 8 wives are actually being cared for because this woman had been raped, or this woman had been previously married and her husband died, or maybe this was my right, and I am caring for them underneath my household. And, you know, great theological minds had to wrestle that one out and say, what honors God more, to divorce these 8 wives or to keep them? And so, anyway. Oh, yeah.
So Bilhah.
Oh. Bilhah.
Bilhah.
Yeah.
Technically, isn't that his brother's mother?
No, she's a handmaid. So she is Leah's. Leah's. Rachel's handmaid, Zilpah, is that her name? She's dead. Sorry, she's dead. Yeah, so this is a nurse. So she's not family. So. It's like having a servant. It's like, oh, you're a big deal. Like, you come with, wow, you got someone to rub your feet and, you know, make you a sandwich. And, like, that their job was to care for them. So not only did, sometimes they would actually nurse them as well. Like, that would be the wet nurse or whatever if mom didn't want to do it. So, I mean, it was a big deal. And that was a nice gift to have, you know. So, but their job was to serve that child. So, yeah. And often the, I guess, husband in the process. So there would have been, wasn't always that pure, so, okay? So again, odd text, okay? All right, 37, let's pick up there. We got like 4 minutes. We'll talk a little bit about Joseph, okay? So again, 37 all the way to 50, we're going to get the story of Joseph. Now, this is just, man, this is some of the most incredible dramatic history. I mean, it's just, this story is absolutely amazing. And I think even the stories that have been done on it don't do justice to what God has written here. Okay, so 37, let's pick up there. 37:1.
Jacob lived in the land of his father's sojourn in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing a flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report on them to his father.
Okay, so how old's Joe? 17, right? So he's a teenager. He is a high school junior, okay? And he brings back a bad report regarding his brothers, okay? Why would you be bringing back a bad report about your brothers? What is their occupation? They're shepherds, right? So they take care of sheep all day, okay? So what does that tell you about Joseph's role in the family? If he's bringing back a bad report, what does that mean? What's his job?
Like a
he's the manager. He's the boss. Where does he fit in the birth order? Rit-roo. He's like second to last. Now, Benjamin's back home watching VeggieTales. Like, he's young, okay? Joseph is the oldest, or the youngest of the brothers that can actually go out and work, okay? So Benjamin is at home. So you look at this two ways. What did Jacob see in Joseph that he would put him in charge of all of his older brothers? Right? Now, do we know that's the case from Joseph's life? This guy is wicked gifted administratively. Amazing, right? We're going to see that for the rest of his life. I think Jacob went, this guy's got the chops to lead. And he put him in a position, regardless of his age, to lead, because that's what he did really, really well, okay? Now, if you're Reuben or Leah, or from Leah, or one of those brothers, and you're much, much older than this kid, what is your tendency going to be? Man, you spoiled, snotty little brat. You know, dad made you manager. I had a professor in college that her husband worked in like a lumber yard, and they had the yard dogs and the lap dogs, okay? The guys that worked outside were the really hard-working guys. They were called the yard dogs because they didn't work in the air conditioning, and then they called all the other guys that worked inside and pushed pencils the lap dogs. Like, oh, that's so cute, right? You guys deal with AC, and, you know, we're outside in 110-degree weather and sweating. So he's kind of a favored kid, and we're going to see that. And Jacob doesn't help that. Joseph is too, I don't know if it's a sin, but he just doesn't quite catch on to, he doesn't make it a lot better either, right? So he doesn't have a lot of tact, or maybe, not tact's the right word, but there's probably times he could have kept stuff to himself, and he chooses not to, and he kind of just worsens the problem because he says stuff that maybe he could have just held in, okay? So that's the idea. So he brings back a bad report. So his brothers are not doing a great job. They're off. They're not being, dad's not with them. They're pasturing the flock wherever. They're up in Shechem, we're going to see. They're all around. They're taking the flock to green pastures wherever they can find them. And Jacob says, how are they doing? And he says, not so good, okay? Now, verse 3, here comes another problem in their relationship. What do you call that? That's favoritism, right? That's hard. And you think the other sons knew all that? Absolutely. Not only did he feel that way and like they could perceive that, but what does he do? He gives his youngest son a trophy and says, you're my favorite. Sorry, all the rest of you. That's my favorite son. He's better than all of you. So you can see how this situation's not going to end real good. Okay, so we'll pick up there tomorrow and watch the fleshing out of how this goes. All right, so enjoy your day. We'll see you guys in the mañana.